Brian Kemp begins preparing his transition to the governor's office, but Stacey Abrams says not so fast. Lucy McBath joins the Democratic wave headed for the U.S. House. 7th District voters wait to learn who they elected to Congress. Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. Thanks for joining us for what is still a post-election edition of Political Rewind. We have an all-star panel for you to break down what happened at the election and, for that matter, what is continuing to happen. Jim Galloway, the lead political writer for the AJC, is with me as he is on Mondays and Fridays. You read him in the Wednesday and Sunday paper. You've just posted a really interesting column for this Sunday, and we're going to talk about it a little bit later in the show. But yeah, hi.
Hello. Are you awake?
Yeah, basically. I hope you are, too. Teresa Tomlinson, the mayor of Columbus, Georgia, is with us. She is a Democrat and is about to finish. You've got about a month left, a month and a half?
Let's see, 6 weeks, I think.
Yeah. Last time you were here, we said, but who's counting? Dr. Andra Gillespie is with us. She, of course, is an associate professor of political science at Emory University. And when is this Obama book coming out?
March 1st.
Oh, my gosh. Congratulations. Yeah. All right. We look forward to that. And the mayor of Sandy Springs, Rusty Paul, who was chairman of the state Republican Party, who was a longtime advisor and sidekick to Jack Kemp during his days as Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, and also worked with him on his presidential campaign. Rusty, we've been kidding you since you got to the studios that you're now awash in a sea of blue all around you up there in Sandy Springs.
Well, as I said, it's deja vu all over again for somebody who's been doing it as long as I have. I started out when it was a sea of blue, and we changed it red, and now it's shifted, at least in the area where I live.
Right. Okay.
Quite dramatically.
All right. We'll get to all of that as we go forward. So we all know the polls closed at 7 o'clock on Tuesday night, and the race that we were focused on, most especially that race between Stacey Abrams and Brian Kemp for governor. By 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock on Wednesday morning, we weren't sure where things stood, although Brian Kemp did have a lead throughout Wednesday. Nobody was willing to call the race. It wasn't until about mid-morning on Thursday that Brian Kemp went into the governor's office with Nathan Deal, and this is what happened.
It was a tough election, but we've won, and now I've got to move on. But the process is true and has been for many, many years in Georgia. And that's another reason that, we're going to have a new Secretary of State that certifies the election, to make that clear.
And Jim Galloway, there we see him with a picture, because Brian Kemp resigned as Secretary of State to begin what he says is his transition, appointed a temporary and acting Secretary of State.
Who will serve until we figure out the runoff between Brad Raffensperger and
John Barrow. Let's go back to Kemp. He's declared victory. He and Nathan Deal has already said he's the next governor. Johnny Isaacson, David Perdue, all of the leaders of the state Republican Party have said it's his. Stacey Abrams throughout the week said, we are not giving up until every vote is counted. But is it clear at this point Brian Kemp will be the next governor?
I think it's going to take something very dramatic for Abrams to recover the 24,000, 23,000 votes that needed just to push Kemp into a runoff right now. And Kemp is doing what governors have always done. They face an immediate January deadline because they've got the General Assembly getting ready to meet. Yeah. And he needs to get to work on his version of a budget.
Yeah, that was Rusty. That was one of the things that the governor said during this news conference the other morning. He said, I'm going to start turning over the budget process. Let him be sitting in on those meetings. So this is a fascinating situation. You've got Stacey Abrams and her team of advisors and lawyers saying, we are going to fight for every single last vote. And you've got a sitting governor saying to the governor in waiting, he believes, let's get to work together.
Well, having been part of a transition team where you didn't have the same party, I was part of Sonny Perdue's transition team when Roy Barnes, who wasn't happy about the transition, was part of it. And you do. The amount of work to put together administration in such a short period of time, the decisions you've got to make, the staffing decisions you've got to make, you can't wait. You have to start. And so I think it's wise and prudent for him to be doing that.
Well, but just what I'm alluding to, of course, is this interesting conflicting scenario that's underway here. One says it's over, the other says no, it's not.
There's not a reason in the world that press conference had to take place yesterday. And in fact, I feel it was unfortunate. It was not only presumptuous, but perhaps a little air of arrogance that just wasn't necessary, particularly in light of what we've gone through as a state with these various accusations. We were talking earlier before we went on the air about how it's troublesome and people should get out of the business of talking about elections being rigged or not valid or, you know, any of that. We have a great election system in this country and in this state, but things like what happened yesterday was unnecessary. There's no reason why that couldn't have happened on Monday. And because of him being the referee and the candidate and all the things we've been talking about, voter suppression and the problems with the absentee ballots in Gwinnett County and that type of thing, let the votes be counted. We still literally have provisional ballots. As of the time that occurred yesterday afternoon, Muskogee County had 500 ballots that hadn't even been counted yet.
Andra, help us with this. Jim already started us in this direction. I believe that where we stand as of the end of the week is that Abrams was behind Kemp by some 63,000 votes. She needed 23 plus thousand to bring it close enough for a recount. She needed 24,000 plus to actually bring Kemp under 50%. Right? She needed probably 25,000 to bring it into bring him under 50 and trigger a runoff. Have I got that about right?
That's about right. And I think the important thing to sort of figure out here, and I don't know the answer to the question because I'm not a member of either campaign or the media, is how many outstanding votes are there? Mm-hmm. So they must know things that I don't know. And so Kemp seems to think that there aren't enough extra ballots out there to be counted. Abrams has an opposing point of view. So you can see why both candidates have made the decisions that they've made. It makes sense that Kemp would presume victory and try to proceed with his transition. And it also makes sense that Abrams has decided that she's going to fight till the last vote is counted because this race is so close.
Jim, how does this then unfold in the days ahead?
Well, we've got Veterans Day on Monday. So on Tuesday, counties will start to certify their counts. Mm-hmm. And at some point, days after that, maybe the week following, you know, maybe Thanksgiving week, we'll see the new Secretary of State, the acting Secretary of State, certify those returns, and that's where we could end up in court. We're already, although we've already got several lawsuits in the works.
Yeah, lawsuits that are going to challenge missing ballots or people who may not have had the right and provisional ballots to get their vote counted, Andra?
I mean, I think it's really important for those who are listening to the radio right now to know that one of the other reasons to kind of keep this race up in the air is that, you know, people who cast provisional ballots have until 5 p.m. today verify their identity and to make their vote valid. So, I mean, if you had to cast a provisional ballot and you haven't gone back with your ID, right, your vote won't get counted.
And that's the first, that was the first real deadline. Right. Yeah. And I think in the past history on that is maybe roughly half of those provisional ballots don't count.
Right. That's counted. That's the typical ranges. And also there are absentee ballots that are still coming in that were postmarked by Tuesday and they have to be received by 5 o'clock on Friday. But I do want to say, I don't think that we should let this moment go without realizing the fact that we're sitting here and debating that Stacey Abrams is within 65,000 votes and whether or not that is going to force Brian Kemp into a runoff, when just a year ago this show, when we were in breaks and afterwards, we were talking about the fact that the Casey Cagle campaign was privately laughing about what a romp this was going to be. They thought that they were going to get 68, maybe even 69% of the vote if Stacey Abrams was the nominee. It was such a shoe-in.
And this is the thinnest margin that a governor has gotten. I mean, if he does indeed become governor-elect, it'll be by the thinnest margin. I think ever. I'm not quite sure. At least in the last 40 years.
Well, that's one of the things that I've learned in over 40 years of participation. There's one day every 2 years that the voters just shove the politicians and the pundits aside and take control of the system and do what they doggone well please. And that's what happened on Tuesday. Yes.
So let's for the time being, let's put the outcome of this race on the sidelines. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, we'll just put that aside. Kemp and Abrams continuing to battle over whether he is, in fact, as he says, the governor-elect of Georgia, whether she has an opportunity to somehow catch up to him. We're going to put that aside for a minute, because there are still, regardless of that, some overarching themes of this election that are really interesting. And to set that up, let's say you just said it, extraordinary that a Democratic candidate for governor in this century should come so close is a pretty remarkable thing. Lucy McBath, the Democrat, upsets Karen Handel in the 6th congressional district. You know about the 6th district, Rusty. It looks like Rob Woodall, he's about 900 votes ahead of Bordeaux, Carolyn Bordeaux, in the 7th. Hard to tell where that goes.
I think there will be a recount. Isn't that a mandate? Aren't they within the mandatory recount?
I think they are within the mandatory recount. Okay, so there are all those things happening. So let me start, because you're a bunch of really smart analysts, by saying, what are the big takeaways for you on this election? Rusty, let me just start with you.
Well, step one, as I say, there were a couple of things that I'm taking away. One, the shift of power from the metropolitan areas to the rural areas was tectonic. In a shift. You wiped out 13 Republican seats in the metropolitan areas, and that's huge from the point of view that those people who were elected in those 13 Republican seats will be in the minority and have very little influence there. And so all of the suburban influence, of particularly on the north side, just was washed away in one evening.
So let's make clear what you're talking about. Andre, he's talking about the fact that Democrats won 13 seats. I think it's 11 House seats, 2 Senate seats, took them away from Republican incumbents or empty seats that a Republican had occupied before stepping out of a race. And with a Republican majority, just to make sure everybody's clear on this, they're going to be Democrats from Metro who won't have a lot of power in the legislature, but they're there.
But it suggests that Democrats are becoming increasingly more competitive, but that it's not evenly distributed through the state.
Yeah.
And so I think especially for the metro area, what was probably once considered an inner ring suburb of Atlanta and what's an exurb of Atlanta has started to shift further out. And so now we're starting to see that, like, as Atlanta suburbs expand, that we're seeing that they're becoming increasingly competitive and Democrats have an opportunity to win. I think it's also important to realize that part of this is the changing demographics. And so as the north metro suburbs have become more diverse as migration patterns have changed. So you don't see African Americans necessarily coming into the city of Atlanta, but moving to the suburbs. As immigrant groups don't settle in cities, but they start off in suburban areas, right? We're starting to see that this has a ripple effect on our politics.
Okay, so there's two themes that you mentioned, Teresa. One of them is this new power in the northern suburbs for Democrats, with a Lucy McBath and a Carolyn Bordeaux coming so close.
Yeah, which was really unthinkable. I mean, again, what a transformation. I have a couple of R's to observe, Bill. One is Republicans. I hope my Republican friends hear the thunder of a two-party system coming. And I think that hopefully people will start making adjustments in the sort of power structure that runs this state. And perhaps we will moderate our language and our politics a bit. Race. 97% of African-American women voted for Stacey Abrams. 75 to 76% of white women voted for Brian Kemp. I think 24% of white people ended up voting for Stacey Abrams, and maybe 5-6% of African-Americans voted for Brian Kemp. That is very, very polarizing and something we need to talk about as a state and, frankly, talk about very frankly. And the other observation is along the lines of what Rusty said, and that is rural. I talk a lot about the Black Belt because I passionately believe that there are a lot of folks in the Black Belt that believe in progressive principles, whose lives and livelihood depend on progressive principles, and yet they do tend to vote red. I'm talking about 50 counties. About 25% of them usually go Democratic, and I felt like we could make some ground. We lost eight. of the 25. And so something is going on. I'm not sure I fully appreciate it yet until we can look at some numbers, but something's going on. So Republican race and rural.
Okay, which to me, what happened on Tuesday was yet another alignment of Georgia's political structure. To Rusty's point, we now have a Republican Party that isn't based on suburban and rural, suburban-rural alliance. It's based on an exurban rural alliance, and you've got Democrats finally seeing a window where they have a population base big enough to become competitive in any kind of statewide race, and especially in a 2020 race. What we saw was a collapse of the GOP within suburban Atlanta.
Mm-hmm. So let me take that a slightly different direction, but really in keeping with what you're saying. Brian Kemp built his campaign around winning enough votes in rural Georgia to head off whatever Stacey Abrams would do in the city of Atlanta and the counties around it, because his people knew that the demographics were changing, that the 6th and 7th were trending blue. So this election, am I right, Andra? Is it fair enough to say, put in a different structure, this was the triumph of rural Georgia over Metro Atlanta, because it was rural Georgia that gave Brian Kemp the votes he needs to presume he's the next governor?
So I think there are two ways to look at this. So one, in terms of thinking about Georgia, I've lived here for 13 years now, thought about this as Atlanta versus the rest of the state, and people having to remember that while Atlanta is a liberal bastion, it only makes up about half the state. Right. And so I think it's always important for us to remember to not ignore or exclude people who are from outside of the metro Atlanta area and places that are more rural. On the other hand, I think it's also important to realize that as now it looks like the Democratic Party has consolidated power around metro Atlanta, that if this part of the state grows more rapidly than other parts of the state, then that portends greater competition. And so I wouldn't recommend that a Republican Party rely on a solely rural strategy, because if the metro areas are growing at a faster rate than the rural areas, then eventually the metro areas are going to dominate and people are going to have to figure out how to talk to each other.
But is it fair to say that in this election, that's basically what happened? I mean, Kemp outperformed Trump in many counties across rural Georgia.
Yeah, I think it worked. I think the question is for how long?
The problem with candidates is they don't look very far into the future. They look to the next election. They'll let the next election beyond that. They'll deal with that when they get there. And, that's what Brian Kemp did. He looked at the numbers and said, this is what we've got to do to win. Mm. And it was focused on rural Georgia. The challenge is he going to strengthen that base and rely on that base, or is he going to try to expand it and try and recapture some of the suburban areas? I'm hoping, as one who lives in the suburban areas and has to kind of help govern in that area, that he'll take on a more expansive role. Nathan Deal was very good to suburban and urban Georgia. Yeah. That's where the growth is. It's where the economic engine is. And it's going to take a little bit of a balance to make
it
work.
And we're going to find out pretty quickly when the General Assembly comes back in January, because we will have transportation to deal with. We will have probably a religious liberty fight again, and it will be interesting to see how hard the GOP leaders of the legislature push that, because you still do have some GOP members in suburbia who can hold on to their
seats. But their voices have been muted somewhat as a result,
right.
And the moderating voices in the Republican Party that looked at the suburban-urban issues a little bit more. Like, take Karen Handel. I mean, she ran on opioid abuse and a lot of things that people care about, not really being hard right in the positions that she took. It didn't matter. Mm-hmm. It did not matter.
Well, yes, Kemp implemented a Sonny Perdue strategy. It's a little musty. We don't know how long it's going to last, but it worked this time around, it appears. The other thing I would say that we have to talk about, and you've mentioned Lucy McBath a couple of times.
Yeah, I want to talk about the 6th
But I am telling you, Lucy McBath and Carolyn Bordeaux
are largely a result of the Pave It Blue movement. These women in suburban Atlanta who mobilized after Trump's election and almost carried Ossoff over the line, and now apparently have absolutely carried Lucy McBath and maybe Carolyn Bordeaux, we will see. I think that that is shocking, and I want to see, I said a moment ago about race and so forth, I want to see what those white women numbers are in the 6th and the 7th, because that's going to tell you something. It's going to tell the Democratic Party about how to phrase our messages of progressive principles to encourage white women to vote for the Democratic Party.
But it's not just looking at white women. So when I looked at the numbers county by county, what we know so far, and it's going to be a couple weeks before we have the turnout numbers broken down by race and gender, but Handel, for all intents and purposes, collapsed in Fulton County, mm-hmm. right? She gets actually, I mean, she still wins Fulton. She still wins Cobb County by smaller margins. She and McBath were neck and neck in Fulton County. That's why she lost. Mm-hmm. And so we have to figure out, is this because there's a surge in turnout amongst African-Americans, particularly amongst African-American women, that offsets the support that Handel is used to?
Now, I'll tell you, this is where it gets granular here. I was talking to Fran Miller, the state senator from Dunwoody. Sally Harrell. And he said what he found the Democrats were doing right in Dunwoody and in Sandy Springs was they were going into the apartment complexes.
Yes.
That's correct.
They were knocking on the apartment complex doors where young people and people of color mm-hmm. are.
Yes.
You can follow the blue streak through North Fulton. It starts in Buckhead and goes all the way up through Sandy Springs into Roswell and hangs a right into Johns Creek. And if you follow that corridor, it's where all the apartments are located in those areas. And so I would second that. I think that's exactly what happened. There were signs up in the apartments telling people where to go. There were buses making sure they got to the polls. Stacey Abrams had probably the best ground game I've seen in the state of Georgia ever in getting people to the polls, and that's where it is. The question is, can the Democratic Party maintain that going forward? And we'll see that, too.
Yeah, absolutely. All of this and a little extra. My mother, 79 years old, lives in Megan Hansen's district up there. And so
she lost.
Republican, she lost too. Yeah. I tell you, I have never seen, I'm from the 6th district, grew up there, I've never seen the mobilization of women that are adamant to do something different in the wake of Trump. It's this Pave It Blue that I'm talking about. There's something going on there. And I think if we really want to see for the Democratic Party, how we can grow even beyond the urban and suburban areas, we need to look at the 6th and 7th district and see how they persuaded those constituencies.
So am I wrong, Andra, to believe that even if she ends up as the loser of this race, Stacey Abrams can take some satisfaction in the fact that her presence at the top of the ticket helped Lucy McBath get over the top in that district? I mean, I'm assuming she had some force in that happening.
So, yeah, I mean, I'm starting to think that, especially with those Fulton County numbers. But the other thing that I'm also looking at that makes me think that this is not a fluke is, you know, the fact that John Barrow is in a runoff, the fact that Lindy Miller is in a runoff for the Public Service Commission. I mean, you know, so it wasn't just Stacey Abrams. I think that she does a lot. And the other reason why I would say that this isn't a fluke, you know, from the wider question of can black candidates be viable statewide, she does better than Jason Carter does amongst white voters, right? Mm-hmm. She doesn't hit the goal, but she does better, right? So there is something to be said about her being able to more than hold her own. And so hopefully the Democratic Party of Georgia is never shy about putting forward the best candidate for a particular office if they happen to be a person of color.
Amen.
Bill, sorry. Let me point, because you hit a nice point. Chuck Eaton in that Public Service Commission, he was abandoned by a lot of Republican voters, and there's a reason for that, and it's over in East Georgia called Plant Vogtle. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of people felt that he was in the pocket of Georgia power and was giving away too much, and a lot of Republicans were very upset about his role in those decision makings, and so he was abandoned. His fall off,
even though he had the IBEW endorsement,
right? He's in trouble with his base because of that, and that's going to be a political issue going forward.
Well, and let me make this observation, which is fascinating. You have Stacey Abrams, you have John Barrow, two completely polar opposites of what the Democratic Party is today, and yet John Barrow, who was down the ballot is only 30,000 votes under what Stacey Abrams pulled. Now, Sarah Meeko didn't make that. She was over 100,000 vote difference, and she was right underneath Stacey Abrams. That's fascinating. Something's going on there. When you start looking at these numbers, we're going to learn a lot more.
So let's be clear for everybody out there. John Barrow in a runoff. We mentioned it briefly with Brad Raffensperger for Secretary of State. Yes. One of the things we've said about Barrow for a long time, though, Jim, is that from the very beginning of this, there were a lot of people who thought Barrow was the one Democrat who might be able to crack the Republican hold on the constitutional offices. And part of it was that he was a pretty popular member of Congress, and he was so well-liked and was so capable of winning votes across the party lines that the Republicans had to keep moving him into different districts to get rid of him.
Yeah, he was redistricted three times.
He had his house on wheels so he could follow his district around.
One of the things about Barrow is that he's one of those politicians people have just gravitated to because there's something they like about how he does business. And he ran those spots saying, yeah, I'm a Democrat, but I don't bite.
And I will tell you what, if Democrats are smart, I think what they will do is they will take whatever anger is left with the Abrams campaign and try to challenge it, channel it into that Secretary of State.
Yeah, if they're smart, but they
have a new Secretary of State to handle this problem.
And continue the fight over voter security suppression.
But you're right. But the lesson here, I think, with John Barrow and Stacey Abrams is let's stop talking about are you a Bernie Democrat? Are you a Hillary Democrat? What people are voting for is authenticity. They will vote. They will vote for who they think is going to be real with them.
All right. I've got to stop the conversation because I'm already really late in getting to a break. So let's right now take our first break of the show and come back with a lot more on Political Rewind.
Each fall, GPB is your go-to for all things high school football. And this year, we're back and ready to play.
You asked for it.
And you got it.
Football Fridays in Georgia is back on the field this fall.
Back on the field.
Back on the field, baby.
On GPB.
Don't miss Football Fridays in Georgia, live on GPB.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Jim, I've been trying to figure out the correct way to frame this question, so I'll just blurt it out and hope that it makes some sense. There has been so much acrimony around the governor's race. From early on, the Abrams camp and Democrats saying Brian Kemp is suppressing registration, suppressing votes. He cannot run the election as secretary and be Secretary of State and also be the candidate. Then at the end of the race, we have this accusation out of nowhere, the Kemp campaign and the Secretary of State's office accusing the state Democrats of, you know, trying to hack into voter rolls, presumably to do some manipulating of the votes. So there's all of this bad feeling about how the election is unfolding. Are we coming close to a situation in which Georgians, like people in other states, might be questioning whether they can trust the outcome of this election? And how dangerous is that for our democracy?
Well, number one, if it does escalate, yes, it's extremely dangerous. I mean, right now we're watching the counting of ballots in Florida, and we're thinking, my goodness, it's 2000 again.
Yeah.
And we've got, we're back to hanging chads. It will be interesting to see what, please help me with her name, Robin Crittenden?
Crittenden, who's the acting Secretary of State.
Secretary of State, what she does in the next 2 weeks, I think. And I will be, one of the first questions facing her is what does she do with this Kemp accusation that Democrats were a party to a hacking conspiracy? Yeah. Mm-hmm. No evidence was ever presented.
Andre, you're a political science professor. How do you talk about this to your student? What do you say about whether we are now questioning whether we can have honest elections? And what will that mean to the future?
Well, we're talking about Congress, and we're going to transition into media, so I'll get to campaigns and elections in a couple of weeks, and so we'll talk about it more then.
Okay.
But, in terms of this idea of trust, I think because because trust has eroded, right, it is understandable that Abrams has taken the tack that she has. On Twitter, when I brought up other factors in the race that, you know, may have suggested why Abrams was behind, I got all of these comments on Twitter about this was a stolen election. And so I think that, you know, is small anecdotal evidence about sort of our eroding trust. But it's also understandable that given the allegations that were raised during the campaign, when the results of an election are as close as they are, people want to make sure that every stone is turned before they draw a conclusion.
Yeah. One of the burdens of elected office is leadership. And this is really now at Brian Kemp's doorstep. I think we can see a moment where I hope he stands up and should this all work out as he prematurely predicted it would yesterday, that he stands up and says, we're going to get this right going forward. And frankly, a redemptive George Wallace moment where he says, I deeply regret the pickup truck commercial. I understand I am the governor of some 2 million
Georgians. Does he have to say that very specifically?
The more specific, the better for healing purposes.
Okay.
But you know, you have a moment to sort of transcend. I hope he is the man his supporters believe he is. And if he is, I hope we will see him take a leadership role and say, I'm going to do things better.
Rusty?
Well, I agree with Teresa that it comes down to leadership. All of us in office have a responsibility to moderate our language. Mm-hmm. To make sure that when we get elected, we're the representatives of the people that voted for us and the people who didn't vote for us. And we have to take that into consideration. And it's not unusual that you have this kind of high-pitched emotion right after a very close election. And, yeah, there were some things done during the course of the election. Not since Dick Cheney has a shotgun caused more political hot hazard. But these things kind of go away. But it's those of us who have leadership positions cannot go out and undermine the system, because there are mistakes made in every election, mm-hmm. but they kind of even out over the course of every area. There were a lot of people in my precinct, I had to wait an hour and a half to vote, yeah. who left early, who didn't vote because they couldn't stand in line for an hour and a half. We had 5 voting machines in one of the largest precincts in North Fulton County. So that was a mistake. It had an impact. Did it change the course of election? No.
So regardless of who ends up winning this race, they're going to have to, at a very minimum, make the overture that they're the governor of all of Georgia, yeah. and not just the people who voted yeah. for them. And so, you know, if Brian Kemp ends up being governor, he has 2 choices. He could either model himself after Nathan Deal, or he can model himself after Donald Trump. And so, and part of that is choosing how to listen to people and to let folks know that I may not always agree with you, but I'm going to listen and actually actively consider what it is that you have to say. If he doesn't do that, then that is going to cause more problems and create even more tension.
Some obligation also on the loser to step up. You know, it's interesting. Karen Handel fought a very tough fight against Lucy McBeth. She's certainly not happy that she lost.
Right.
But and she didn't want to talk to the media mm-hmm. at all.
And I don't know that she talked to Lucy McBeth either.
So that's interesting. I wasn't even thinking about whether she called Lucy McBeth. I was going to say, at least she issued a gracious statement congratulating McBeth and wishing her well. Now, if she didn't call her, it may not mean quite as much.
You know, a couple of things, I think. You're absolutely right. And Stacey has an obligation to fight this, because her entire campaign was, get out there and vote mm-hmm. for me, and your vote's going to count. She is a steward of those voters, and so she has to do this. But I have great faith that she is a leader, and it's going to be handled appropriately, however it comes down. But let me make this point, which is fascinating. So when Governor Deal gets the microphone for the first time after several months, what's the first thing he does? He appoints an African-American woman, a Yale Law graduate, to this position in order to imbue some sort of credibility to the certification of this highly racially charged election. I think that Brian Kemp would do well. Why was that not done? Of course not. No. And he had thought about it, because he's been governor for 8 years of 10 million people. And so Brian Kemp would do well to attempt to emulate some of the leadership he's seen. And I think you have to ask yourself, why in the world was this not done
3, 4, 5 months ago. I mean, why in the world was Secretary Crittenden not appointed many months ago to save us this?
I mean, this is something I think the General Assembly should take up. Like, optics matter. Yeah. And then also, I think we just have to ask the normative question of should partisans be in charge of the Secretary of State?
I will tell you what, they will take that up if John Barrow wins on December 4th.
Yeah. Rusty Paul, I have to tell you, Tom Faust tells me that Facebook Live, you have a couple people who I think are not necessarily Republicans who said you're talking their language of leadership. So congratulations to you for that.
Leadership matters. I grew up in Birmingham, Alabama in the 60s. Mm-hmm. And I watched what that did to my hometown. And I am very cautious in these matters because your rhetoric and these things matter. So I try to be very, very measured.
We get in such a strategy and we let politics lead and then the policy follow. It's amazing, amazing how if you'll lead with policy, the politics will follow. Yeah. I mean, it really will. And so I think what we've seen over the last few years and in this election was that politics were put first. It caused all this havoc and the policy was somewhere in there. And so I hope we'll start seeing a reverse of that trend.
All right. So let me go back to this notion of whether the Secretary of State ought to oversee an election in which she or he is participating. We've said on the show on any number of occasions that Kathy Cox was Secretary of State when she ran for re-election to that job. And then, of course, while she ran for governor. We've already got Kathy getting, we're going to put Kathy on the show in about a week or so to talk about how she feels about that whole issue now. But Jim, nobody blinked twice back when that happened with Kathy Cox. Is that how in the trenches we are now in terms of our warfare? Did people suddenly wake up about it?
What's the difference? I think the difference is that in 2007, Republicans seized on voter security as an issue. And that they started with voter ID, and then you progressed to purging. We had exact match passed, I think, three sessions ago,
something like that.
Voter security means entirely different things to Democrats and Republicans.
So he's right, isn't he, Andre? I mean, to some extent, Republicans sowed the seeds for the distrust that they have had to deal with today, with all of their attempts at so-called voter security to prevent fraud in the elections. It did bring attention to their efforts.
So, I mean, I think there are a couple of things here. There's the letter of the law and there are norms. And then there is also sort of this idea of that we're more tribal and more polarized today. And so we didn't think about this, but perhaps we should have thought about this ahead of time, that there would come a moment where people would be highly ambitious and would use the Secretary of State's office as a stepping stone for statewide office. And we needed to have a contingency plan in order to figure out what to do about those folks. Mm-hmm. Right. So we didn't think about it before. It should have been thought about sort of in greater depth when this decision was made. And now is our time to go back and think about whether or not this is working for us.
So it didn't become an issue when Lewis Massey was running. You know, he was Secretary of State and ran for governor.
That's right.
So, this kind of this partisan approach to this job is kind of astonishing to me because it's always been done. Yeah. And elections are done at the county level. You're the head of a county that is responsible for maintaining the elections there. This really is more done at the local level, and with the complaints that everybody's hearing has come more from local voter offices than it has from the Secretary of State's office.
And that's true. But when, I'm also, as you are, the CEO of 15 departments and 3,000 people. But when one of them aren't getting it right, guess who has to answer for it? So that's the way it works. But I find it remarkable that we actually have a deputy Secretary of State. I don't know if anyone here knows his name, but it's Mr. Sullivan. He happens to be, no offense, but a middle-aged white man. And so it was interesting that he did not naturally was not the appointed one. So I think we see political optics, obviously, with Ms. Creighton. But why in the world do we not have just a custom and a practice, if not statutorily a regulation, that's saying that the sitting deputy secretary takes over?
All right. So, it'll be interesting to see, as Jim says, what might happen in the months ahead, especially if the Democrat wins that runoff. Okay, so let's talk, because you two were talk about being in the heat of battle. What the heck happen. Voters out there across the state, aside from caring about who won, wins or loses this election, what they want to know is, what the heck happened county by county that there weren't enough machines, mm-hmm. there were power cords that weren't delivered to certain precincts? How could counties not have been prepared, given what they knew about the interest in this election from the very beginning of early vote? What happened?
Well, prepare for wildly divergent views on that question.
I would say
this. Well, I know what Jim's going to say, that there is a lawsuit, but the order did not say produce an insufficient amount of voting machines, so there's utter chaos on Election Day. That's ridiculous that it was interpreted that way. And you can see, again, going back to leadership, an utter lack of leadership and thinking through in order to provide direction to our 159 counties, which you should never take for granted. And I've said this many times, but, you know, Casey Cagle, when he ran, really was tough, as people are in elections, and he wanted to win, obviously. But he said over and over again, a Republican, that Brian Kemp was incompetent, that he had showed himself to be incompetent in various ways, and then he listed them all. And so he said, we can't trust him to be a leader. He's not a strong leader. And so for those Democrats out there, I think that what we saw on election night was an office that did not have strong leadership, either because Casey Cagle was right or because he was preoccupied with his campaign.
If I'm the head of a county, Jim, I can order the number of machines, and you know where they are warehoused.
But the Secretary of State can say, look, now we are under a federal order, and I want to make sure that you're not withholding too many machines.
The lawsuit that you're talking about is in reference to the insecurity, the touchscreen, no paper trail.
Vastly outdated.
Yeah, yeah. But how does that limit the number of machines you could put in play on election day?
The federal judge, Amy Totenberg, ordered. I don't know that she put a number on it.
But they did sequester a large number, about 2,000 machines in the metro
area. Fulton and DeKalb sequestered several hundred of them.
We had five in one of the largest voting precincts in North Fulton County. It took an hour and a half, and they had 25 voter cards. That was a decision made by the Fulton County Voter Registration Office, not by the Secretary of State's office, how many each precinct got. They shipped a bunch into inner city Atlanta during the course of the day because of complaints. We didn't get any new ones in North Fulton, and I'm not complaining about that. That's just the
numbers. It was the same way in Cobb.
Yeah.
But that's a failure of leadership. Somebody should say, we have this order. We need to look at how we're going to field these machines and still comply with the order. It was left to 159 counties.
So, Andrea, here's yet another mm-hmm. issue. Forget about whether, you know, there was voter suppression or whatever, and maybe all of this plays into it, but maybe there was just not good thinking about the enormous interest in voting in this election. I don't want to get into this in specific detail, but I know there are counties which could reliably count on a heavy turnout of Democratic votes, and they didn't have enough machines, and they're run by Democrats. So it's a little bit strange.
So this is why, what I got in trouble on Twitter about. When we're thinking about sort of why the outcome looks the way that it does, there are many factors to consider. Should we make sure that, like, there were no dirty tricks played? Absolutely. Then there are these process questions that you're bringing up. And so if process is playing a role, then you have to give it its due. Then you have to think about sort of, you know, mobilization and turnout. And then you also just have to think about the fundamentals of the state, how many Democrats relative to Republicans there are in the state. So this and some other factors likely all contribute to what the eventual outcome of the election is. And if we sort of take our tribalism and our emotionalism out of it and actually actively sort of, you know, and objectively consider sort of what's going on here, I think that'll actually move us further to the truth, as opposed to just sort of, you know, pointing fingers at one
another. Let me make this point. And this was it was great. I love being in the poll for an hour and a half as a political scientist mm-hmm. myself, because I could watch voter behavior in a real live laboratory. And people would go through and they would vote. And I couldn't see how they were voting, but I could see what the mental process. And when they would get to those amendments, they would slow down, and it would take some people 8 to 10 minutes to vote because of the amendments that they were trying to figure out.
They obviously hadn't listened to our Political Rewind, where we broke every one of them down.
Or read the newspaper.
There you go.
I was fascinated by that. I've
got to interrupt because we've got to get our final break of the show out of the way. And when we come back, we still have a lot more to talk about. This is Political Rewind.
A Seat at the Table is a weekly series hosted by Deneen Milner, Christine White, and Monica Pearson. The mission of A Seat at the Table is to let African-American women have a platform to educate communities about the Black woman's experience, life, and journey.
Today, we're talking about using the N-word.
Is a college education still necessary in today's world?
Today, we're talking about what it means to be woke.
From credit to entrepreneurship, Black women are about our business.
Join us for A Seat at the Table on GPB.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Jim Galloway, Teresa Tomlinson, Dr. Andre Gillespie, Rusty Paul, all at the table. And Tom Faust just told me in my ear that I can't monitor Facebook Live when I'm on this set as easily as I'd like to, that that community thinks this, they want you all to come back for every show. It's basically, they like you very much as a panel, so you all should know that. So let me go a different direction. Rusty, you started, and Teresa, you both did, really. You talked about the fact that if Kemp is the governor, he's got a moment where he can try to bring people together. And I thought, Andre, you said such a smart thing about, you know, he can go the way of Trump or Nathan Deal. Mm-hmm. Nathan Deal, there was not, when he first came into office, mm-hmm. he had a very conservative past. There were Democrats who were upset about some of the things that he had done while he was a member of Congress. They didn't trust that he really could be a moderate force. And in his first, I don't know, in the first part of his administration, he did pass some very conservative legislation, particularly in terms of immigrants. And yet, Jim, he chose to become a governor who crossed party lines, that people really trusted that he had the best interests of the state at heart.
And he started listening to the business community quite a bit.
Yeah.
And I think that made the difference.
Well, and that's what I was going to ask about. Obviously, the business community was with Casey Cagle during the primary. And the question is, they sort of reluctantly had to shift over to Brian Kemp. Is that marriage that was kind of a shotgun wedding? I hate to use that terminology after the Kemp commercials, but is that going to have to be worked on, Rusty?
I think it'll come together fairly naturally and fairly quickly. I know the business community is very pragmatic. They're more interested in who's winning than anything else, and they'll come to the table. And you know, you looked at Sonny Perdue on the flag issue. Just go back there. You know, he ran to change the flag. He sat down with the business community. They laid out what the problems were going to be, and Sonny made the adjustment.
Well,
Sonny was pushed into that.
All right, hold on.
The business community pushed him.
All right, so you think that's one constituency. Mm-hmm. Nathan Deal also was able to reach out to the minority communities, the African-American community,
Calvin
particularly. Worked with Calvin Smyre, your guy in Columbus and the mayor, and he did criminal justice reform.
Mm-hmm.
Brian Kemp's got a big, big margin. He's got to make up a chasm to get the minority community.
I will tell you what, the thing that I am most eager to watch see unfold is how he deals with Medicare.
Yes.
Medicaid. And Medicaid expansion, how he frames that, because as we said at the beginning, this is a candidate who owes everything to rural Georgia, and rural Georgia is the one getting it in the neck right now because of a lack of health care.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Andre, where does he go in terms of trying to get the African-American community to feel that he can represent them, do you imagine?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's going to take a lot of work, and it's not just the things that have been done with respect to voting rights, but it's also thinking about immigration. So it's not just all African Americans.
Yeah,
it's also a recognition that we, you know, have a state that's about 10% Asian American and Latino, and thinking about what the rhetoric looks like. But it's also having a softer tone that's actually that appears to be informed by conversations, deep historically grounded conversations, so that it's clear that he understands why people had concerns with certain things. So especially over the issues with exact match. The lawsuits are, you know, the allegations that are in the lawsuits are, look, minorities are being disproportionately affected by this. So he's still stuck on, well, that wasn't our intention. And I can't judge whether or not that was his intention. But when the effects are overwhelmingly people of color are being affected by this, I need you to understand that perhaps there's a problem here. And so even if I didn't intend for something bad to happen here, something bad has happened and I need to come up with something better to fix it.
It strikes me that that's important. All right, here's another constituency. Anybody who reads the national media press and watches mostly the liberal media, MSNBC, Brian Kemp is being excoriated for his attempts at voter suppression. They contend. Read the New York Times. Read the Washington Post. Mm-hmm. Read even the Wall Street Journal has, at a couple of occasions, gone after him. Watch MSNBC. Teresa, you talk about having to put up the best front for the country, especially in terms of attracting business. And mm-hmm. how does he work on that issue?
I would say he needs to leave religious liberty behind. Mm. He needs to step out, as I suggested earlier, and say, you know, we really need to get this voting thing right because we have 43% minorities in this state, and I respect each person. But, you know, the other thing that's very interesting about this is we lost a lot of big personalities in the Georgia legislature. We lost, of course, the very respected Wilbur
Wendell Willard.
My city attorney.
We lost then some other personalities such as Josh McCoon and Schaefer and Teasley and Betty Price. And so what is this legislature going to look like? You know, and he has a real opportunity to set a new tone. You have some folks who remember, who are still there, who remember when, who are Republicans, who remember when they were in the minority, or remember when they were Democrats and in the majority.
And now they're
Republicans. And so they have an opportunity to join with, and let's assume for a moment that Brian Kemp is, as he, as I said, presumptuously said yesterday, going to be the next governor. Then they have a moment to set the tone for Georgia. So it is one of these top business getting states.
All right. I want to change the conversation completely for the last few minutes that we have here, because we've had a contentious week. We've gone through a contentious election. We're trying to figure out how do we heal, assuming we can. I will say I always hope we can do that with Political Rewind. Always. That's my number one goal, is making sure you all get a chance with your different voices to talk respectfully to one another and help our listeners understand where you're coming from. But Jim, That's not as important as the fact that the state just this past week lost someone who was beloved across every line of politics and race, and Harris Hines
of Marietta.
You should talk just for a minute about him.
I'm going to get his age wrong if I guess it, but he's not too much older than I was. He and his wife were driving up from South Metro Atlanta, car accident. He was killed. His wife got through it. Funeral is on Tuesday. He was just a longtime jurist, one of the most friendly people at the state capitol that you could possibly find. I think Zella appointed him back in the day.
Yep.
He had just retired in this fall.
I think in August.
Yes. He had turned 75, and that's what his age was there.
Yes.
But I tell you what, the last time I really had a nice conversation with him, it was a Sunday lunch. We were on the square in Marietta. He lived nearby. He stopped by. He recognized me. He stopped by and he chatted with me and my wife. And must have been 20 minutes or so. And he was, you know, there is something Southern about the way that people engage for a long period.
Did you work?
Yes.
You're a lawyer.
Well, my husband and I had the opportunity of knowing him personally and having the opportunity to see outside the sort of professional realm of him being a justice on the Georgia Supreme Court. And he was a lovely man and had a wonderful sense of humor, a wonderful sense of humor, a great storyteller. And so he will be greatly missed. But he's one of the statesmen. Never met a stranger kind of guy, and he was much beloved.
Rusty, as we're talking, Jane Hansen, who's the communications person for the state Supreme Court, sent out an advisory that on Tuesday, the day that there will be a service for Harris Hines, the flags will be lowered to half staff to recognize him.
First Presbyterian Church of Marietta.
Yeah.
They're expecting such a huge turnout that it's going to be live streamed, the funeral services.
I just thought it was really important to say a few words about Harris Hines.
No, that's very appropriate.
Finish.
I didn't know him as well as you guys did. I knew him more by reputation and by other lawyers and judges who had worked with him. And he was revered. No matter if you were on his side or not, you respected him. And that's the sign of a great judge.
Mm-hmm. We're about out of time. Andre Gillespie. Andre, you have been working overtime. You've been here. You did a whole night at Channel 11 where we got to see a little of you when we weren't on the air here. So thank you so much
thank
for
you.
Ending your week with us here. Jim Galloway, you know it's always wonderful to have you with us. And Rusty Paul and Teresa Tomlinson. Come back. Our Facebook people want you back on every show, so okay. Let's see if we can make that happen.
We've got cities to run, but yeah. we're available anytime.
That's it. Yeah. That's about it for us. Again, it has been a difficult week, and I'm always kind of this mushy guy who says, please, if there's any way we can find common ground, come together. I hope you'll do that by listening to us. But more important, I hope you'll start working with neighbors of yours who don't share your political views. Listen to them. Hear what they have to say, and maybe you'll get a chance to talk back to them about your feelings. That's my very, very sentimental way of saying I hope we can heal as this election season comes to an end. I'm Bill Nigut. See you again on the next Political Rewind.